"Look what happens when you sleep with one of the judges," whispered Lucy. "Mum, shh," hissed Tess, glancing over her shoulder for scandalized eavesdroppers. Besides, she didn't want to think about Liam in relation to Connor. That confused everything. Liam and Connor belonged in separate boxes, on separate shelves, far, far away from each other. She watched her small son shuffle across the playground to accept his gold trophy cup filled with tiny Easter eggs. He turned to look for Tess and Lucy with a thrilled, self-conscious smile. Tess couldn't wait to tell Will about it when they saw him this afternoon. Wait. They wouldn't be seeing him. Well, they would ring him. Tess would speak in that cheerful, cold voice women used when they spoke to their ex-husbands in front of their children. Her own mother had used it. "Liam has good news," she'd tell Will. And then she'd pass Liam the phone and say, "Tell your dad what happened today." He wouldn't be daddy anymore. He'd be your dad. Tess knew the drill. Oh, God, did she know the drill? It was hopeless to try and save the marriage for Liam's sake. How ridiculous she'd been, deluded, thinking that it was simply a matter of strategy. From now on, Tess would behave with dignity. She'd act as if this was an ordinary, run-of-the-mill, amicable separation that had been on the cards for years. Maybe it had been on the cards. Because otherwise, how could she have behaved the way she had last night? And how could Will have fallen in love with Felicity? There had to be problems in their marriage, problems that had been completely invisible to her. Problems she still couldn't name, but problems nonetheless. What was the last thing she and Will had argued about? It would be useful, right now, to focus on the most negative aspects of her marriage. She forced her mind back. Their last argument was over Liam, the Marcus problem. "Maybe we should consider changing schools," Will had said after Liam had seemed particularly down about some incident in the schoolyard, and Tess had snapped, "That seems a bit dramatic." They'd had a heated disagreement while they were packing the dishwasher after dinner. Tess had slammed a few drawers. Will had made an ostentatious point of repacking the frying pan she'd just put in the dishwasher. She'd ended up saying something silly like, "So are you saying I don't care about Liam as much as you do?" And Will had yelled, "Don't be an idiot!" But they'd made up, just a few hours later. They'd both apologized, and there had been no lingering bitterness. Will wasn't a sulker. He was actually pretty good at negotiating a compromise, and he rarely lost his sense of humor or ability to laugh at himself. "Did you see the way I repacked your fry pan?" he said. "That was a masterstroke, eh? Put you in your place, didn't it?" For a moment, Tess felt her strange, inappropriate happiness teeter. It was as though she was balanced on a narrow crevice, surrounded by chasms of grief. One wrong thought, and down she'd tumble. "Do not think about Will. Think about Connor. Think about sex. Think wicked, earthy, primal thoughts. Think about the orgasm that ripped through your body last night, cleansing your mind." She watched Liam walk back to his class. He stood next to the one child that Tess knew. Polly Fitzpatrick, Cecilia's youngest daughter, who was shockingly beautiful and seemed positively Amazonian next to spindly little Liam. Polly gave Liam a high five, and Liam looked almost incandescent with happiness. Damn it. Will had been right. Liam did need to change schools. Tess's eyes filled with tears, and she felt suddenly ashamed. Why the shame? She wondered as she pulled a tissue from her bag and blew her nose. Because her husband had fallen in love with someone else? Because she wasn't lovable enough, or sexy enough, or something enough to keep her child's father satisfied? Or was she actually ashamed about last night? Because she'd found a selfish way to make the pain disappear. Because right now she was longing to see Connor again, or, more specifically, to sleep with him again, to have his tongue, his body, his hands obliterate the memory of Will and Felicity sitting on either side of her, telling her their horrible secret. She remembered the feel of the length of her spine being flattened against the floorboards in Connor's hallway. He was fucking her, but really, he was fucking them. There was a burst of sweet feminine laughter from the row of pretty, chatty mothers sitting alongside Tess. Mothers who had proper married sex with their husbands in the marital bed. Mothers who were not thinking the word fuck while they were watching their children's Easter hat parade. Tess was ashamed because she wasn't behaving as a selfless mother should. Or perhaps she was ashamed because deep down, she wasn't that ashamed at all. Thank you so much for joining us today, mums and dads, grandmas and grandpas. That concludes our Easter hat parade, said the school principal into the microphone. She put her head on one side and waggled her fingers around an imaginary carrot stick like Bugs Bunny. That's all, folks. What do you want to do this afternoon? Asked Lucy, as everyone applauded and laughed. There are a few things I need at the shops. Tess stood and stretched and looked down at her mother in her wheelchair. She could feel Connor's eyes on her from the opposite side of the yard. She'd always felt somehow wronged by her parents' divorce. As a child, she'd wasted hours imagining how much better her life would have been if her parents had stayed together. She would have had a closer relationship with her father. Holidays would have been so much more fun. She wouldn't have been so shy. How she managed to rationalize this, she didn't know. Everything would have been just generally better. But the truth was, her parents had a perfectly amicable divorce and eventually became relatively friendly. Sure, it was awkward and strange visiting her father every second weekend, but really, what was the big deal? Marriages failed. Children survived. Tess had survived. The so-called damage was all in her mind. She waved at Connor. New lingerie was what she needed. Extremely expensive lingerie that her husband would never see. Chapter 38. Cecilia left the Easter hat parade and drove straight to the gym. She got on the treadmill, put the incline and speed up as high as they could go, and ran as if she was running for her life. She ran until her heart pounded, her chest heaved, and her vision blurred from the sweat dripping into her eyes. She ran until there wasn't room for a single thought in her head. It was a wonderful relief to not be thinking, and she felt like she could have run on for another hour, if it wasn't for one of the gym instructors stopping abruptly and quite unnecessarily in front of Cecilia's treadmill and saying, "You okay there? You don't look too good to me." "I'm fine," Cecilia went to say, furious with him for bringing the real world crashing back into her consciousness, except that she couldn't talk, or breathe, actually. And at that instant, both her legs turned to jelly. The instructor grabbed her around the waist and slammed the palm of his hand on the treadmill to stop it. "You've got to pace yourself, Mrs. Fitzpatrick," he said, helping her off the treadmill. His name was Dane. He taught a weights class that was popular with the St. Angela's crowd. Cecilia often did it on a Friday morning before her weekly grocery shop. Dane's skin was young and dewy. He looked about the same age as John Paul had been when he killed Janie Crowley. "I reckon your blood pressure is sky high right now," he said, his eyes bright and earnest. "If you want, I could help you work out a training program that would..." "No, thank you," panted Cecilia. "But thank you. I'm just leaving, actually." She walked away quickly on wobbly legs, still fighting for breath, sweat pooling in her bra, ignoring Dane's entreaties to do a few stretches, to cool down, to at least drink some water, Mrs. Fitzpatrick. You've got to rehydrate. On the way home, she decided that she couldn't live another moment with this. It was impossible. John Paul would have to confess. He'd turned her into a criminal. It was preposterous. While she was in the shower, she decided that confessing wouldn't bring Janie back, and Cecilia's daughters would lose their father, and what was the point of that? But their marriage was dead. She couldn't live with him. So that was that. While she was getting dressed, she made her final decision. John Paul would turn himself into the police after the Easter break, give Rachel Crowley the answers she deserved, and the girls would just have to live with an incarcerated father. As she blow-dried her hair, it was suddenly blindingly obvious to her that her beautiful daughters were all that mattered, were her only priority, and that she still loved John Paul, and she'd promised to be true to him in good times and bad, and life would go on as it always had. He had made a tragic mistake when he was 17. There was no need to do or say or change anything. The phone was ringing when she turned off the hairdryer. It was John Paul. "I just wanted to see how you are," he said gently. It was like he thought she was ill. Or, no, it was like she was suffering from a uniquely female psychological condition, something that was making her fragile and crazy. "Marvelous," she said. "I feel just marvelous. Thanks for asking." Chapter 39. "Happy Easter," said Trudy to Rachel as they packed up the office that afternoon. "Here, I got you a little something." "Oh," said Rachel, touched and annoyed, because it hadn't occurred to her to get a present for Trudy. There had never been any exchanging of gifts with the old school principal. They'd rarely exchanged pleasantries. Trudy handed over a charming little basket filled with a variety of delicious-looking eggs. It looked like the sort of thing Rachel's daughter-in-law would buy her. Expensive, elegant, and just right. "Thank you so much, Trudy. I didn't..." She waved her hand to indicate her absence of a gift. "No, no." Trudy waved back to indicate it wasn't necessary. She'd stayed in her bunny suit for the entire day and looked, Rachel thought, perfectly ridiculous. "I just want you to know how much I appreciate the work you do, Rachel. You carry this whole office, and you let me be... me." She lifted one of her rabbit ears out of her eyes and gave Rachel a level look. "I've had some secretaries who found my working approach somewhat unusual." "I bet they did," thought Rachel. "You make it all about the children," said Rachel. "That's who we're here for." "Well, you have a lovely Easter break," said Trudy. "Enjoy some time with that scrumptious grandson of yours." "I will," said Rachel. "Are you going away?" Trudy didn't have a husband or children or any interests that Rachel knew of outside the school. There were never any phone calls of a personal nature. It was hard to imagine how she'd be spending the Easter break. "Just faffing about," said Trudy. "I read a lot. Love a good whodunit. I pride myself on guessing who the murderer is." "Oh." Her face turned bright pink with distress. "I quite like historical fiction myself," said Rachel quickly, avoiding her eye and pretending to be busily distracted with picking up her bag and coat and Easter basket. "Ah." Trudy couldn't recover her equilibrium. Her eyes filled with tears. The poor girl was only 50, not that much older than what Janie would have been. Her kooky, grey, wispy hair made her look like an elderly toddler. "It's fine, Trudy," said Rachel softly. "You didn't upset me. It's perfectly fine." Chapter 40. "Hi." Tess answered her phone. It was Connor. Her body responded instantly to his voice, like Pavlov's salivating dog. "What are you doing?" he asked. "I'm buying hot cross buns," said Tess. She'd picked up Liam from school and taken him to the shops for a treat. Unlike yesterday, he seemed quiet and moody after school and not interested in talking about his Easter hat win. She was also buying a whole list of things for her mother, who had suddenly realized the shops would be closed the next day, for one whole day, and had gone into a panic about the state of her pantry. "I love hot cross buns," said Connor. "Me too." "Really? We've got so much in common." Tess laughed. She noticed Liam looking up at her curiously, and she turned slightly away from him so that he couldn't see her flushed face. "Anyway," said Connor, "I wasn't calling for any particular reason. I just wanted to say that I thought last night was really nice." He coughed. "That's an understatement, actually." "Oh, God," thought Tess. She pressed the palm of her hand to her burning cheek. "I know things are really complicated for you right now," continued Connor. "I don't have any expectations, I promise you. I'm not going to make your life more complicated. But I just wanted you to know that I'd love to see you again. Any time."
"Mum?"
Liam pulled on the edge of her cardigan.
"Is that Dad?"
Tess shook her head.
"Who is it?"
demanded Liam. His eyes were big and worried. Tess pulled the phone away from her ear and put a finger to her lip.
"It's a client."
Liam lost interest immediately. He was used to conversations with clients. Tess took a few steps away from the crowd of customers waiting to be served at the bakery. "It's okay," said Connor. "Like I said, I really don't have any..."
"Are you free tonight?" interrupted Tess.
"God, yes."
"I'll come over once Liam is asleep."
She put her lips close to the phone, as if she was a secret agent.
"I'll bring hot cross buns."
Rachel was walking towards her car when she saw her daughter's murderer. He was talking on his mobile phone, swinging his motorbike helmet held loosely in his fingertips. As she got closer, he suddenly tipped back his head to the sun, as if he'd just received unexpectedly wonderful news.
The afternoon light glinted off his sunglasses. He snapped the phone shut and slid it in his jacket pocket, smiling to himself. Rachel thought again of the video and remembered the expression on his face when he turned on Janie. She could see it so clearly. The face of a monster, leering, malicious, cruel. And now look at him. Connor Whitby was very alive and very happy, and why wouldn't he be? Because he'd got away with it. If the police did nothing, as seemed likely, he would never pay for what he'd done. As she got closer, Connor caught sight of Rachel, and his smile vanished instantly, as if a light had been snapped off. Guilty, thought Rachel. Guilty, guilty, guilty. This came by overnight courier for you, said Lucy, when Tess was home unpacking the groceries. Looks like it's from your father. Fancy him managing to send something by courier. Intrigued, Tess sat down at the kitchen table with her mother and unwrapped the small bubble-wrapped package. Inside was a flat, square box. He hasn't sent you jewellery, has he? Asked her mother. She peered over to look. It's a compass, said Tess. It was a beautiful, old-fashioned wooden compass. It's like something Captain Cook would have used. How peculiar, sniffed her mother. As Tess lifted up the compass, she saw a small handwritten yellow post-it note stuck to the bottom of the box. Dear Tess, she read, this is probably a silly gift for a girl. I never did know the right thing to buy you. I was trying to think of something that would help when you're feeling lost. I remember feeling lost. It was bloody awful. But I always had you. Hope you find your way. Love, Dad. Tess felt something rise within her chest. I guess it's quite pretty, said Lucy, taking the compass and turning it this way and that. Tess imagined her father searching the shops for the right gift for his adult daughter, the expression of mild terror that would have crossed his leathery, lined face each time someone asked, "Can I help you?" Most of the shop assistants would have thought him rude, a grumpy, gruff old man who refused to meet their eye. Why did you and Dad split up? Tess used to ask her mother. And Lucy would say airily, a little glint in her eye, oh, darling, we were just two very different people. She meant your father was different. When Tess asked her father the same question, he'd shrug and cough and say, you'll have to ask your mum about that one, love. It occurred to Tess that her father probably suffered from social anxiety too. Before their divorce, her mother had been driven to distraction by his lack of interest in socializing. But we never go anywhere, she would say, full of frustration, when Tess's father once again refused to attend some event. Tess is a bit shy, her mother used to tell people in an audible whisper, her hand over her mouth. Gets it from her father, I'm afraid. Tess had heard the cheerful disrespect in her mother's voice and had come to believe that any form of shyness was wrong. Morally wrong, in fact. You should want to go to parties. You should want to be surrounded by people. No wonder she felt so ashamed of her shyness, as if it were an embarrassing physical ailment that needed to be hidden at all costs. She looked at her mother. Why didn't you just go on your own? What? Lucy looked up from the compass. Go where?
Nothing, said Tess. She held out her hand. Give me back my compass. I love it.
Cecilia parked her car in front of Rachel Crowley's house and wondered again why she was doing this to herself. She could have dropped Rachel's Tupperware order off at the school after Easter. The guests from Marla's party weren't promised delivery until after the break. It seemed she simultaneously wanted to seek Rachel out and avoid her at all costs. Perhaps she wanted to see her because Rachel was the only person in the world with the right and the authority to speak out on Cecilia's current dilemma. Dilemma was too gentle a word. Too selfish a word. It implied that Cecilia's feelings actually mattered. She lifted the plastic bag of Tupperware from the passenger seat and opened the car door. Perhaps the real reason she was here was because she knew Rachel had every reason in the world to hate her, and she couldn't bear the thought of anyone hating her. I'm a child, she thought, as she knocked on the door. A middle-aged, perimenopausal child. The door opened faster than Cecilia had expected. She was still preparing her face. Oh, said Rachel, and her face dropped. Cecilia. I'm sorry, said Cecilia. So very, very sorry. Are you expecting someone? Not really, said Rachel. She recovered herself. How are you? My Tupperware. How exciting. Thank you so much. Would you like to come in? Where are your girls? They're at my mother's place, said Cecilia. She felt bad because she missed their Easter hat parade today. So she's giving them afternoon tea. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. I won't come in, I'll just... You sure? I've just put the kettle on. Cecilia felt too weak to argue. She would do whatever Rachel wanted. Her legs could barely hold her up, they were trembling so badly. If Rachel shouted, "Confess!" she would confess. She almost longed for that. She walked across the threshold with her heart in her mouth, as if she was in physical danger. The house was very similar to Cecilia's home, like so many of the homes on the North Shore. Come into the kitchen, said Rachel. I've got the heater on in there. It's getting chilly in the afternoon. We had that linoleum, said Cecilia when she followed her into the kitchen. I'm sure it was the height of fashion all those years ago, said Rachel as she put tea bags into cups. I'm not one of those renovating types, as you can see. Just can't get myself interested in tiles and carpets, paint colours and splashbacks. Here you go. Milk? Sugar? Help yourself. This is Janie, right? Asked Cecilia. And Rob? She'd stopped in front of the refrigerator. It was a relief to say Janie's name. Her presence was so gigantic in Cecilia's head. It felt like if she didn't say her name, it would suddenly burst out of her mouth in the middle of a sentence. The photo on Rachel's fridge was casually held with a magnet advertising Pete the 24-hour plumber. It was a small, faded, off-center color photo of Janie and her younger brother holding cans of Coke and standing in front of a barbecue. They'd both turned around with blank, slack-mouthed expressions, as if the photographer had surprised them. It wasn't a particularly good photo, but somehow its very casualness made it seem all the more impossible that Janie was dead. Yes, that's Janie, said Rachel. That photo was up on the fridge when she died, and I've never taken it down. Silly, really. I've got much better ones of her. Have a seat. I've got these biscuits called macarons. Not macaroons, oh no, if that's what you're thinking. Macarons. You probably know all about them. I'm not very sophisticated. Cecilia saw that she took pride in not being sophisticated. Have one. They're really very good.
Thank you, said Cecilia. She sat down and took a macaron. It tasted like nothing, like dust. She sipped her tea too fast and burned her tongue.
Thank you for dropping off the Tupperware, said Rachel. I'm looking forward to using it. The thing is that tomorrow is the anniversary of Janie's death. 28 years.
It took Cecilia a moment to comprehend what Rachel had said. She couldn't work out the link between the Tupperware and the anniversary.
I'm sorry, said Cecilia. She noticed with almost scientific interest that her hand was visibly trembling, and she carefully placed her teacup back in its saucer.
No, I'm sorry, said Rachel. I don't know why I told you that. I've just been thinking about her a lot today, even more than usual. I sometimes wonder how often I would have thought about her if she'd lived. I don't think about poor Rob that often. I don't worry about him. You'd think after losing one child that I'd be worried about something happening to my other child. But I'm not particularly worried. Isn't that awful? I do worry about something happening to my grandson, to Jacob.
I think that's natural, said Cecilia. And suddenly she was overcome by her own breathtaking audacity. To be sitting here, in this kitchen, delivering platitudes, along with Tupperware.
I do love my son, murmured Rachel into her mug. She shot Cecilia a shamefaced look over the rim.
I'd hate you to think I didn't care for him.
Of course I don't think that.
Cecilia saw to her horror that Rachel had a triangle of blue macaron right in the center of her bottom lip. It was horribly undignified and made Rachel seem suddenly elderly, almost like a dementia patient.
I just feel like he belongs to Lauren now. What's that old saying? A son is a son until he takes him a wife. A daughter is a daughter for all of her life.
I've heard that. I don't know if it's true.
Cecilia was in agony. She couldn't tell Rachel about the crumb on her lip, not when she was talking about Janie. Rachel lifted her teacup for another sip, and Cecilia tensed. Surely it would be gone now. Rachel lowered the cup. The crumb had moved off-center and was even more obvious. She had to say something.
I really don't know why I'm rambling on like this, said Rachel. You're probably thinking I've lost the plot. I'm not myself, you see. When I came home from your Tupperware party the other night, I found something.
She licked her lips, and the blue crumb vanished. Cecilia sagged with relief.
Found something? She repeated. She took a big mouthful of her tea. The faster she drank, the faster she could leave.
It was very hot. The water must have been boiling when Rachel poured. Cecilia's mother made the tea too hot as well.
Something that proves who killed Janie, said Rachel. It's evidence.
New evidence. I've given it to the police.
Oh, dear. Cecilia, are you okay? Quickly, come and run your hand under the tap.
Chapter 41. Tess tightened her arms around Connor's waist as his bike swooped and dipped around corners. The streetlights and shop fronts were blurry streaks of coloured light in her peripheral vision. The wind roared in her ears. Each time they took off at a set of traffic lights, her stomach lurched thrillingly, the way it did when she was in a plane taking off from the runway.
Don't worry, I'm a safe, boring, middle-aged bike rider, Connor had told her as he'd adjusted her helmet for her. I stay under the speed limit, especially when I've got precious cargo. Then he dropped his head and gently banged his helmet against hers. Tess had felt touched and cherished, and also idiotic. She was too old, surely, for helmet clinking and flirty little remarks like that. She was too married. But perhaps not. She tried to remember what she'd been doing the previous Thursday night. Back home in Melbourne. Back when she was still Will's wife and Felicity's cousin. She'd made apple muffins, she remembered. Liam liked them for his morning tea at school. And then she and Will had watched TV with their laptops on their knees. She'd caught up with some invoicing. He'd been working on the cough stop campaign. They'd read their books and gone to bed. Wait. No. Yes. Yes. They definitely did. They'd had sex. Quick and comforting. And perfectly nice. Like a muffin. Nothing like sex in the hallway of Connor's apartment, of course. But that was marriage. Marriage was a warm apple muffin. He must have been thinking about Felicity when they made love. The thought was as brutal as a slap. He'd been especially tender when they made love that night, she remembered. She felt particularly cherished, when in fact he wasn't cherishing her, he was pitying her. Perhaps he was even wondering if this was their last time together as husband and wife. The hurt spread instantaneously throughout her body. She squeezed her legs tighter around Connor's body and leaned forwards as if she could press herself into him. When they got to the next set of lights, Connor put back his hand and caressed her thigh, giving her an instant jolt of sexual pleasure. It occurred to her that the pain she was feeling over Will and Felicity was intensifying every sensation, so that what felt good, like the swoop of the bike and Connor's hand on her thigh, felt even better. Last Thursday night, she was leading a soft, muffled, pain-free little life. This Thursday night felt like adolescence, exquisitely painful and sharply beautiful. But no matter how badly it hurt, she didn't want to be home in Melbourne, baking and watching television and doing invoices. She wanted to be right here, soaring along on this bike, her heart thumping, letting her know she was alive. It was after 9 p.m. and Cecilia and John Paul were in the backyard, sitting in the cabana next to the pool. This was the only place where they were safe from eavesdroppers. Their daughters had an extraordinary ability to hear things they weren't meant to hear. From where she sat, Cecilia could see them through the French doors, their faces illuminated by the flickering light of the television. It was a tradition that they were allowed to stay up as late as they wanted on the first night of a school holiday, eating popcorn and watching movies. Cecilia turned her gaze away from the girls and looked at the shimmering blue of their kidney-shaped swimming pool with its powerful underwater light, the perfect symbol of suburban bliss. Except for that strange, intermittent sound like a baby choking that was coming from the pool filter. She could hear it right now. Cecilia had asked John Paul to look at it weeks before he went to Chicago. He hadn't got around to it. But he would have been furious if she'd arranged for some repair guy to come and fix it. It would have indicated lack of faith in his abilities. Of course, when he did finally look at it, he wouldn't be able to fix it. And she'd have to get the guy in anyway. It was frustrating. Why hadn't that been part of his stupid lifelong redemption program? Do what my wife asks immediately so she doesn't feel like a nag.
She longed to be out here having an ordinary argument with John Paul about the damned pool filter. Even a really bad ordinary argument, where feelings were hurt, would be so much better than this permanent sense of dread. She could feel it everywhere. In her stomach, her chest, even her mouth had a horrible taste to it. What was it doing to her health? She cleared her throat. "I need to tell you something." She was going to tell him what Rachel Crowley had said today about finding new evidence. How would he react? Would he be frightened? Would he run? Become a fugitive? Rachel had not told her the exact nature of this evidence because she'd been distracted by Cecilia spilling her tea, and Cecilia had been in such a state of panic it hadn't occurred to her to ask. She should have asked, she realized now. It might have been useful to know. She wasn't doing too well in her new role as a criminal's wife. Rachel couldn't possibly know exactly who the evidence implicated, or she wouldn't have told Cecilia. Would she? It was so hard to think clearly. "What's that?" asked John Paul. He was sitting on the wooden bench opposite her, wearing jeans and a long-sleeved striped jersey the girls had bought him last Father's Day. He leaned forward, his hands hanging limply between his knees. There was something odd about his tone of voice. It was like the gentle, fiercely strained way he would have replied to one of the girls when he was in the early stages of a migraine and still hoping that it wasn't going to take hold. "Have you got a migraine coming on?" she asked. He shook his head. "I'm fine." "Good. Listen, today when I was at the Easter hat parade, I saw..." "Are you okay?" "I'm fine," she said impatiently. "You don't look fine. You look really sick. It's like I've made you sick." His voice trembled. "The only thing that ever mattered to me was making you and the girls happy. And now I've put you in this intolerable position." "Yes," said Cecilia. She curled her fingers around the slats of the bench seat and watched her daughters as their faces simultaneously dissolved into laughter over something they were watching on the television. "Intolerable is a pretty good word for it. All day at work, I was thinking, how can I fix this? How can I make it better for you?" He came over and sat next to her. She felt the welcoming warmth of his body next to hers. "Obviously, I can't make it better. Not really. But I wanted to say this to you. If you want me to turn myself in, I will. I'm not going to ask you to carry this too, if you can't carry it." He took her hand and squeezed it. "I'll do whatever you want me to do, Cecilia. If you want me to go straight to the police or to Rachel Crowley, then that's what I'll do. If you want me to leave, if you can't bear to live in the same house as me, then I'll leave. I'll tell the girls we're separating because... I don't know what I'll tell the girls, but I'd take the blame, obviously." Cecilia could feel John Paul's whole body shaking. His palm was sweaty over hers. "So you're prepared to go to jail? What about your claustrophobia?" she asked. "I'll just have to deal with it," he said. His palm got sweatier. "It's all in my head anyway. It's not real." She flicked his hand away with a sudden feeling of revulsion and stood. "So why didn't you put up with it before? Why didn't you turn yourself in before I even knew you?" He lifted his palms and looked up at her with a contorted, pleading face. "I really can't answer that, Cecilia. I've tried to explain. I'm sorry. And now you're saying I get to make the decision.
It's nothing to do with you anymore. Now it's my responsibility whether Rachel hears the truth or not.
She thought of the blue crumb on Rachel's mouth and shuddered.
Not if you don't want it to be.
John Paul was almost in tears now.
I was trying to make things easier for you.
Can't you see that you're making it my problem? Cried Cecilia.
But the rage was already fading, to be replaced by a great wave of despair. John Paul's offer to confess made no difference. Not really. She was already accountable. The moment she'd opened that letter, she'd become accountable. She sank back down on the bench on the opposite side of the cabana. "I saw Rachel Crowley today," she said. "I dropped off her Tupperware. She said she had new evidence that implicates Janie's murderer." John Paul's head jerked up. "She couldn't have. There's nothing. There is no evidence." "I'm just telling you what she said."
"Well then," said John Paul. He swayed a little, as if he was having a dizzy spell, and briefly closed his eyes. He opened them again. "Maybe the decision will be made for us. For me."
Cecilia thought back to exactly what Rachel had said. Something like, "I've found something that proves who killed Janie."
"This evidence she'd found," said Cecilia suddenly, "it might actually implicate someone else."
"In that case, I'd have to turn myself in," said John Paul flatly. "Obviously I would."
"Obviously," repeated Cecilia.
"It just seems unlikely," said John Paul. He sounded exhausted. "Doesn't it? After all these years."
"It does," agreed Cecilia. She watched as he lifted his head and turned towards the back of the house to look at the girls. In the silence, the sound of the pool filter became loud. It didn't sound like a choking baby. It sounded like the wheezing breaths of something monstrous, like an ogre from a child's nightmare creeping around their house.
"I'll look at that filter tomorrow," said John Paul, his eyes fixed on his daughters.
Cecilia said nothing. She sat and breathed in time with the ogre.
Chapter 42.
"This is sort of the ultimate second date," said Tess. She and Connor were sitting on a low brick wall overlooking DY Beach, drinking hot chocolate in takeaway cups. The bike was parked behind them, the chrome gleaming in the moonlight. The night was cold, but Tess was warm in the big leather jacket Connor had lent her. It smelled of aftershave.
"Yeah, it normally works like a charm," said Connor.
"Except you already scored with me on the first date," said Tess. "So, you know, you don't need to waste all your seductive charms."
She sounded odd, as if she was trying out someone else's personality. One of those sassy, feisty girls. Actually, it was like she was trying to be Felicity, and not doing a very good job of it. The magical, heightened sensations she'd felt on the bike seemed to have dissipated, and now she felt awkward. It was too much. The moonlight, the bike, the leather jacket, and the hot chocolate. It was horribly romantic. She'd never been fond of classic romantic moments. They made her snicker. Connor turned to look at her with a deadly serious expression.
"So, you're saying the other night was a first date?"
He had grey, serious eyes. Unlike Will, Connor didn't laugh a lot. It made his occasional deep chuckles all the more precious. "See,
quality, not quantity, Will.
Oh, well, said Tess. Did he think they were dating? I don't know. I mean, Connor put his hand on her arm. I was joking. Relax. I told you, I'm just happy to spend time with you. Tess drank some of the hot chocolate and changed the subject. What did you do this afternoon? After school? Connor squinted, as if considering his answer, and then shrugged. I went for a run, had a coffee with Ben and his girlfriend, and, well, I saw my shrink. Thursday evening, I see her, at 6 p.m. There's an Indian restaurant next door. I always have a curry afterwards. Therapy and an excellent lamb curry. I don't know why I keep telling you about my therapy. Did you tell your therapist about me? Said Tess. Of course not. He smiled. You did. She poked his leg gently with her finger. All right, I did. Sorry. It was news. I like to make myself interesting for her. Tess put her cup of hot chocolate down on the wall next to her. What did she say? He glanced at her. You've obviously never been in therapy. They don't say a word. They say things like, and how did that make you feel? And why do you think you did that? I bet she didn't approve of me, said Tess. She saw herself through the therapist's eyes. An ex-girlfriend who broke his heart years ago suddenly reappears in his life when she's right in the middle of a marriage crisis. Tess felt defensive. But I'm not leading him on. He's a grown man. Anyway, maybe it will go somewhere. It's true I never thought about him after we broke up, but maybe I could fall in love with him. In fact, maybe I am falling in love with him. I know he's all messed up about his murdered first girlfriend. I'm not going to break his heart. I'm a good person. Wasn't she a good person? She felt a dim awareness of something almost shameful about the way she'd lived her life. Wasn't there something closed off, even small-minded and mean, about the way she cut herself off from people, ducking down behind the convenient wall of her shyness, her social anxiety? When she sensed overtures of friendship, she took too long to respond to phone calls and emails, and eventually people gave up, and Tess was always relieved. If she was a better mother, a more social mother, she would have helped Liam cultivate friendships with kids other than Marcus. But no, she'd just sat back with Felicity, giggling over their wine and sniping. She and Felicity didn't tolerate the overly skinny, the overly sporty, the overly rich, or overly intellectual. They laughed at people with personal trainers and small dogs, people who put overly intellectual or misspelled comments on Facebook. People who use the phrase, I'm in a very good place right now. And people who always got involved. People like Cecilia Fitzpatrick. Tess and Felicity sat on the sidelines of life, smirking at the players. If Tess had a wider social network, then perhaps Will wouldn't have fallen in love with Felicity. Or at least he would have had a wider range of potential mistresses at his disposal. When her life fell apart, there wasn't one friend Tess could call. Not one friend. That's why she was behaving like this with Connor. She needed a friend. I fit the pattern, don't I? Said Tess suddenly. You keep choosing the wrong women. And I'm another wrong woman. Said Connor. Also, you didn't even bring the hot cross buns you promised. He tipped back his paper cup and drained the last of his hot chocolate. He put it down on the ledge next to him and shifted closer to her. "I'm using you," said Tess. "I'm a bad person." He put one warm hand on the back of her neck and pulled her close enough so she could smell the chocolate on his breath. He took the paper cup from her unresisting hand. "I'm using you to help me not think about my husband," she clarified. She wanted him to understand. "Tess, honey, do you think I don't know that?" Then he kissed her so deeply and so completely that she felt like she was falling, floating, spiraling, down, down, down. Like Alice in Wonderland. The 6th of April, 1984. Janie didn't know that boys could blush. Her brother Rob blushed, but obviously he didn't count as a proper boy. She didn't know that a smart, good-looking private school boy like John Paul Fitzpatrick could blush. It was late in the afternoon and the light was changing, making everything indistinct and shadowy. But still, she could see that John Paul's face was glowing. Even his ears, she noticed, were a translucent pink. She just said her little speech about how there was this other guy she'd been seeing, and he wanted her to be his sort of, girlfriend. So she really couldn't see John Paul anymore, because the other guy wanted to make things sort of official. She'd had this vague idea that it would be better to make it sound as if it were Connor's fault, as if he was making her break up with John Paul. But now, as John Paul's face reddened, she wondered if it had been a mistake to mention another boy at all. She could have blamed it on her father. She could have said that she was too nervous about him finding out that she was seeing a boy. But part of her had wanted John Paul to know that she was in demand. "But Janie..." John Paul's voice sounded girly and squeaky, as if he was about to cry. "I thought you were my girlfriend." Janie was horrified. Her own face flushed in sympathy, and she looked away towards the swings and heard herself giggle. A strange, high-pitched giggle. It was a bad habit she had of laughing when she was nervous, when she didn't find anything at all funny about a situation. It had happened, for example, when Janie was 13, and the school principal had come into their homeroom with such a somber, mournful expression on his normally jolly face, and told them that their geography teacher's husband had died. Janie had been so shocked and distressed. And then she'd laughed. It was inexplicable. The whole class had turned to look at her accusingly, and she'd just about died of shame. John Paul lunged at her. Her first fleeting thought was that he was going to kiss her, and this was his odd yet masterful technique, and she was pleased and excited. He wasn't going to let her break up with him. He wasn't going to stand for it. But then his hands grabbed her neck. She tried to say, "That's hurting, John Paul," but she couldn't speak. And she wanted to clear up this dreadful misunderstanding, to explain that she actually liked him more than Connor, and she'd never meant to hurt his feelings, and she wanted to be his girlfriend, and she tried to convey that with her eyes, which were staring straight into his beautiful eyes, and she thought for a second that she saw a shift, a shocked recognition, and she felt a loosening of hands. But there was something else happening, something very wrong and unfamiliar was happening to her body, and in that instant, a far-off part of her mind remembered that her mother had been going to pick her up from school today to take her to a doctor's appointment, and she'd forgotten all about it and gone to Connor's house instead. Her mother would be ropeable. Her last properly articulated thought was, "Oh, shit." After that, there were no more thoughts, just helpless, flailing panic. Good Friday. Chapter 43.
"Juice!" demanded Jacob.
"What do you want, sweetie?" whispered Lauren. "Juice," thought Rachel. "He wants a juice? Are you deaf?" It was only just light, and Rachel, Rob, and Lauren were standing in a shivery little circle at Wattle Valley Park, rubbing their hands together and stamping their feet, while Jacob slithered in and out between their legs. He was rugged up in a parka that Rachel suspected was too small for him, his arms sticking straight out like a snowman. As expected, Lauren was wearing her trench coat. Although her ponytail didn't look quite as perfect as normal, there were a few strands escaping from her hairband. And she looked tired. She was carrying a single red rose, which Rachel thought was a silly choice. It was like those roses in long plastic cylinders that young men give to their girlfriends on Valentine's Day. Rachel herself was carrying a small posy of sweet peas she'd picked from her own backyard, tied up with a piece of green velvet ribbon, like Janie used to wear when she was very little. "Do you leave the flowers where she was found? At the bottom of the slide?" Marla had once asked. "Yes, Marla, I leave them there to be trampled by hundreds of little feet," Rachel had said. "Ah, yes, good point," Marla had said, not at all offended. It wasn't even the same slide. All the clunky old metal equipment had been replaced by fancy space-age-looking stuff, just like the park near Rachel's house where she took Jacob, and the ground had a rubbery surface that gave an astronaut-like bounce to your step.
"Juice," said Jacob again.
"I don't understand, sweetie." Lauren flipped her ponytail back over one shoulder. "You want me to loosen your jacket?" "For heaven's sake." Rachel sighed. It wasn't like she ever really felt Janie's presence when she came here. She couldn't imagine her here. Couldn't conceive how she had come to be here. None of Janie's friends had ever known her to come to this particular park. It was a boy, obviously, who had brought her here. A boy called Connor Whitby. He probably wanted sex, and Janie said no. She should have had sex with him. That was Rachel's fault, for going on about it so much, as if losing her virginity was this momentous event. Dying was far more momentous. She should have said to her, "Have sex with whoever you want, Janie. Just stay safe." Ed had never wanted to come to the park where she was found. "What's the bloody point of that?" he said. "Too bloody late to go there now, isn't it? She's not bloody there, is she?" "You're bloody right, Ed." But Rachel felt like she owed it to Janie to turn up each year with her posy of flowers, to apologize for not being there, to be there now, to imagine her last few moments, to honour the last place she'd been alive, the last place where she'd breathed. If only Rachel could have been there to see her for those last precious minutes, to drink in the sight of those ridiculously long, skinny legs and arms, the awkward, angular beauty of her face. It was a silly thought, because if Rachel had been there, then she would have been busy saving her life. But still, she longed to have been there, even if she wasn't able to change the outcome. Maybe Ed had been right. It was pointless to come here each year like this. It felt particularly pointless this year, with Rob and Lauren and Jacob standing around like people waiting for something to happen,
the entertainment to start.
Juice, said Jacob.
I'm sorry, sweetie, I just don't understand, said Lauren.
He wants a juice, said Rob, so gruffly that Rachel almost felt sorry for Lauren.
Rob sounded just like Ed when he got grumpy. The Crowley men were such grumps.
We don't have any, mate. Here, we've got your water bottle. Have some water.
We don't drink juice, Jakey, said Lauren. It's bad for your teeth.
Jacob held his water bottle with fat little hands, tipped back his head, and drank thirstily, giving Rachel a look that said, We won't tell her about all the juice I drink at your place. Lauren tightened the belt of her trench coat and turned to Rachel.
Do you normally say anything? Or,
No, I just think of her, said Rachel in a flat, shut-the-hell-up voice. She certainly wasn't going to let her feelings loose in front of Lauren.
We can go in a moment. It's very nippy. We don't want Jacob getting a chill.
It was ridiculous bringing Jacob here, on this day, to this park. Perhaps in future she'd do something else to mark the anniversary of Janie's death. Go to her grave, like they did on her birthday. She just had to get through this endless day, and then it would be done. For another year. Let's just move it along. Come on, minutes. March on by until it's midnight.
Do you want to say something, honey? Lauren asked Rob.
Rachel nearly said, of course he doesn't. But she stopped herself in time. She looked at Rob and saw he was looking up at the sky, stretching his neck out like a turkey, gritting those strong white teeth, his hands awkwardly clenched across his stomach, as if he was having a fit.
He hasn't been here, realized Rachel. He hasn't been to the park since she was found.
She took a step towards him, but Lauren got there first and took his hand.
It's okay, she murmured. You're okay. Just breathe, honey. Breathe.
Rachel watched, helpless, as this young woman she didn't really know that well comforted her son, who she probably didn't know that well either. She watched how Rob leaned towards his wife, and she thought of how little she knew, had ever really wanted to know, about her son's grief. Did he wake Lauren with nightmares that twisted the sheets? Did he speak quietly in the darkness to her, telling stories about his sister? Rachel felt a hand on her knee and looked down.
Grandma, said Jacob.
He beckoned to her.
What is it?
She bent down and he cupped a hand over her ear.
Juice?
He whispered.
Please.
The Fitzpatrick family slept late. Cecilia woke first. She reached for her iPhone, sitting on the bedside table, and saw that it was 9:30.